This is going to be, when historians write this, the era of Trump, whether we like it or not. Welcome to Shield of the Republic, podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments and a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center. And I am joined in this final podcast on those two platforms by Elliot Cohen, my partner in all things strategery and the professor emeritus of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. Elliot, I know you're under the weather, so I'm not going to ask you how you are.
Well, I'm going to tell you anyway. I feel miserable. I got a head cold, and I'm going to be flying to Japan, so I'm feeling really sorry for myself. You will see me drinking for this. It's not beer. It's green tea.
Okay. Well, that's good.
So we should move to jackasseries.
But before you do, I just have to observe that the Washington Post had a story about tea drinkers. It's very good for longevity. They tend on average to live longer than non-tea drinkers. So good on you.
Right. I'm doing my best on that front. We're going to talk later on about the future of Shield of the Republic because we've got a lot of very exciting things planned as we look to our future as an independent platform. But I know you're going to speak to that later. It's been a week of a lot of jackassery. So let me open with, I think, one really major jackassery, which is dangerous. You know, we dunk a lot on Pete Hegseth, but this is one where Trump himself has done something which is extraordinarily damaging, and that is to order this very severe reduction in exercises with the South Koreans. And, you know, until now, he has spent most of his time insulting, belittling, disparaging, pistol whipping our European allies. He's now doing it in the Asia Pacific. And this is a particularly stupid way of doing it. If you look at his statement on Truth Social, I think you can see why he's doing it. Not that, you know, the reasons are in any way valid, because they're not. He expresses resentment that the South Koreans didn't show up in the Iran escapade. And of course, I don't think it ever crosses his mind that, you know, there are reasons for that, namely having to do with his behavior and how they orchestrated this. But I think that is an undercurrent which is going to persist and will, unfortunately, will drive a lot of his behavior towards our allies who, in the way that his mind is, I think, going to reconfigure what happened here is that he was doing this incredible act of generosity for them and, you know, they betrayed us and left us alone. So I think it's actually quite a dangerous signpost. The other one is, you know, he begins talking about his friend Kim Jong-un and he talks about nuclear diplomacy. And I think there you have the coming together of his frustration with Iran. You know, he was going to denuclearize Iran, but also his desire for some big historic accomplishment. Now, to be fair, getting rid of North Korean nuclear weapons has been the great white whale of American foreign policy for a long time, including the administration that you and I served in together.
We both have some scars from that.
We absolutely do. But he's got that bug particularly badly, and that makes it all the worse. It really does. So it's awful. I know you're going to be talking a bit about Trump, so why don't you do that? And then I want to talk about a couple of minor but revealing jackasseries.
Yeah, so actually I've written something on the South Korea business, which will be in the dispatch and we'll put in the show notes. I largely agree with you, and I think this is partially an effort to change the subject, but it's a adjacent subject, if you will, because of the nuclear dimension to it. I mean, it's striking that he gets all the specific particulars, as Daniel Dale on CNN has pointed out, wrong about the exercise, about, you know, the cost sharing, burden sharing that South Korea has done over the years. Everything he says in specific is wrong, including the number of U.S. troops who are in South Korea he gets wrong. So that's, you know, point number one. Point number two is that the Truth Social post makes it clear that he's not only pissed off at them for not showing up in Iran, which, as your colleagues at CSI has pointed out, inflicted, without consulting them, a triple whammy on their economy, raising inflation, depreciating their currency, and increasing the cost of, of borrowing. But it's also the case that, it's not a protection racket. I mean, his anger at the South Koreans is that, they promised, to make investments when he went to South Korea last fall to offset the trade deficit, because he thinks the trade deficit somehow is, an indication of them taking advantage of us, as opposed to us buying cheap goods from South Korea because they make good electronics and cars and what have you. So this is, his effort to kind of balance the books, if you will, transactionally. And it doesn't seem to occur to him that there's a benefit to the United States for its presence in South Korea and its longstanding alliance, which the two sides have shed blood over going back to the Korean War in 1950. And number two, that what he's doing is not just, it's not just limited to South Korea, the damage. It's rippling through the rest of the Indo-Pacific, in particular in a week when the USS George Washington, the only aircraft carrier we have in the theater, is being redirected to the Middle East to relieve the long-suffering Abraham Lincoln. And, the upshot of this, in my view, is to call into question the U.S. security guarantee for our treaty allies in the Indo-Pacific, and perhaps Taiwan as well, which is no longer a treaty ally, but with whom we have some obligations under the Taiwan Relations Act. And it's going to increase what is already, a very lively discussion in South Korea about whether South Korea needs its own, independent nuclear deterrent, and likely the same in Japan, which, as the Financial Times pointed out, has got its security so tied up with the United States that the idea of a plan B is something that, Japanese never even want to contemplate. And what plan B likely will end up being, in my view, in the long run, is a nuclear capability for Japan. But I leave that to you as a homework assignment when you're in Japan to discover whether I'm overreacting or not.
Yeah, well, I'll try to get at that. Just one more moment on the South Korea thing, and you'll be mentioning other things which are pretty awful too. I really do see the whole series of things that we've seen just in this past week as more indication that he was always an unbalanced, probably in some ways narcissistic, but pathological liar and all that. I just have this sense of really serious mental deterioration, because he's doing things which are extremely damaging. He's clearly saying them and doing them right off the cuff. I mean, partly is because he doesn't have anybody around him who can really restrain him anymore. But the thing that worries me most about all this is I think these events that we're discussing are bad enough. It's the trajectory that troubles me. And we do have another 2 years plus of this guy. But Go on with your other jackasseries.
No, I mean, you're right. He's cosseted. I mean, I don't want to get into it because others, have discussed it ad nauseum. But the cocoon he's in, where he's got Natalie Harp, his aide, feeding him this constant, good news about himself and, positive reinforcement for everything. He's completely lost his governor. And I think that's obvious from just the things we're talking about today. So, I mean, on top of what you've discussed, I mean, he this week threatened to bomb Oman, a U.S. ally, because of the Omani-Iranian negotiations over the future of the Strait. Now, why exactly he picked Oman to vent his spleen on? I mean, this negotiation has been going on for a while. It actually doesn't look like it's going anywhere. but if they get in the way, we're going to bomb them. I mean, it's really kind of crazy, as you say. I mean, the other thing is we talked last week about, you know, his insistence on you know, steam catapults for the U.S. aircraft carriers in the Ford class rather than the electromagnetic launch systems that the Ford at long last has, you know, sort of gotten underway. I mean, it took a lot to move to these systems. There were a lot of hiccups, a lot of costs with it. But by all accounts, it's a more efficient, better system that needs less maintenance. But now he wants on the Doris Miller, the next aircraft carrier, to tear that up. We talked about that last week. But wait, there's more. He also doesn't like the way our modern carriers look. He wants them to look like the ones that he grew up admiring, you know, on Victory at Sea in the 1950s that were from the World War II era. So maybe we should move the island, you know, which is the essentially the control tower for the carrier, you know, from the back all the way to the middle of the ship to, you know, meet his aesthetic. I mean, this is crazy in part because it's going to, you know, impose a cost of billions of dollars on the Navy. And what I fear in all this is when you put that together with the $250 billion boondoggle of the Trump battleship, it's going to end up destroying the Navy's shipbuilding program. And we know as historians from studying what happened to British shipbuilding between the wars, that mismanagement of that was a major factor in limiting British rearmament in the late 1930s as Hitler and Japan were upending the global order. So the potential damage here is just enormous. And as I said to you, I'm old enough to have watched Victory at Sea in the 1950s as I was growing up too, but that doesn't make me a naval engineer or architect.
Yeah. I mean, that's right, obviously. I mean, it reveals something even kind of deeper and sicker, which is, I don't think he actually thinks of the military as in anything remotely like a serious way. It's a kind of childish aesthetic view of the military. Now, I think what will happen with the battleships, I suspect with the catapults, I'd be virtually certain with the island, the Navy will slow roll him, because even the sycophants who are getting promoted know that this is truly lunacy. Still, I mean, the Navy is already in very serious straits. And, you know, to have to waste time with this sort of thing, and to have, you know, lots of expensive studies and to pretend you're doing it even when you're not doing it, it's an additional penalty. So, I don't think we're going to have Trump-class battleships. I think the Navy will continue to have catapults. I think the islands will move to the back of the carrier where they belong. But there'll be a lot of wasted time and money. I wanted to add two minor jackasseries, both of which are also in the defense space, because I think they're revealing. So one was just announced by the acting chief of staff of the Army, acting because he's not going to get confirmed, but both Republicans and Democrats have made that clear, General Chris LaNeve, who was a protege of the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, that he is disbanding the experimental battalion that his predecessor, General Randy George, had created in Europe for the purpose of drone warfare. And he's returning them to their primary mission, which is to be airborne infantry, which is a really sounds like a kind of a knuckle-dragging statement. You know, the thing is, when new technologies of this magnitude come in, think of the tank. What people typically do, what advanced militaries do, what serious militaries do, is they create experimental units. I think the United States Marine Corps did some somewhat similar things under General Dave Berger. Different people have argued about whether they went in the right direction or not, but that's what you do. You experiment, and you create units that are going to experiment. It's what we did in the 1920s under, I forget whether he was Major, Lieutenant Colonel, Edna Chaffee. We created an experimental unit. The British created experimental armor units in the 20s. To disband it is, first, it does sound like a kind of a knuckle-dragging thing to do. I mean, I'll stand to be corrected if I'm wrong. you have the distinct sense that he's doing this because he's going to undo what his predecessor did. And of course, this puts him further at odds with the Secretary of the Army, Dan Driscoll, who is, of course, at odds with General Leneve's patron, Pete Hegseth, and probably likely to replace him if and when Hegseth ever goes. So it's a very, very bad sign. I'll couple that with something that will seem even more minor, I am sure, to most of our listeners, but it really isn't. So the Defense Department shut down access by people who are outside the military system to something called DTIC. DTIC stands for the Defense Technical Information Center. What that does is that is a gigantic repository of all kinds of documents, theses, studies, both classified and unclassified, current and declassified. It's an invaluable resource for people who do research. And this is unfortunately part of a larger pattern in the Hegseth Department of Defense, which is profoundly anti-intellectual. I mean, really in a very, very deep way. And I think profoundly ignorant of the extent to which independent research done, yes, sometimes in universities and think tanks, in other places that can draw on this sort of material is a critical part of national defense. And it always has been. I mean, you and I can both recite chapter and verse on this kind of issue. And frequently, you know, some of the most important theorists of warfare, think of somebody like Julian Corbett for the Royal Navy, for example, at the turn of the century, have been civilians who've been using unclassified documents of various kinds. And it's worrisome because you just have a feeling that the Hegseth Pentagon is putting in as four-star officers, not all of them. I mean, I know some of the ones who are not like this, but I know some who are really not interested in thinking about warfare. And this is such at the highest level, the operational strategic level, but instead are at the best technicians and at worst, in some cases, are simply kind of careerists and sycophants. And it's very, very dangerous time to be doing that.
I couldn't agree more. And it's not, I mean, on the, you know, on the DTIC point, it does, I'm sure, sound to our, you know, viewers and listeners as like incredibly nerdy, you know, here are these, you know, too old, you know, superannuated academics, blah, blah, blah. But look, you know, I just did this monograph that you and I have talked about on the show about nuclear command and control. I could not have done some of that research without documents that I found on DTIC. I mean, these are like old reports that are, like, you know, very hard to find unless you have access immediately to a government repository library where you can, you know, track these things down, perhaps in hard copy. So it really is a absolutely essential tool for researchers. And it's not just, I think, I mean, you're right, and it's a very anti-intellectual Department of Defense, but it's also basically another blow at transparency by the Department of Defense. It's just of a piece with not having a press briefing in, I don't know how many, over 100 days, you know, despite the fact that we, you know, have a minor excursion, as the president says, going on in the Middle East that maybe the Department of Defense would like to comment on. It's really just appalling. And I do blame, by the way, the Republicans in the United States Senate who knew that Pete Hegseth was not qualified to be Secretary of Defense and confirmed him anyway.
Yeah. And then are surprised or act surprised. The same thing goes for Robert F. Kennedy. I mean, it's you and I have talked about the spinelessness that we're seeing. Maybe we should move on to, we've been talking tangentially about Iran. There are a couple of further wrinkles even since last week. I'll mention two of them and like to get your reaction. One is there's a report, I think, out of Agence France-Presse, so the French equivalent of something like AP or Reuters, that the Houthis are in Yemen. Are thinking of making a grab for land really on the Bab el-Mandeb, which is the strait that leads to the Suez Canal, and also leads to Eilat in Israel and Aqaba in Jordan. So it's an important strait. The Houthis, of course, are armed by the Iranians. I'm sure you know this is being done at least in coordination with the Iranians, if not indeed at their behest. There's also been talk that there may be a Saudi land offensive against the Houthis. So I'm not sure quite what to make of it other than to say, watch this space, and to say that we have assumed, the administration assumes, that this conflict stays contained. And I think there's a pretty good chance that actually it doesn't stay contained, that it spreads in a various way. I mean, the Iranians, for example, have made noises about striking at Europe. And we know they have the missiles with range to do that. The other thing, which is I find more intriguing, is there have been a number of reports. So this must have been, I think, quite deliberately leaked by the administration, that the U.S. has actually been able to set up a system where oil is coming out of the Strait of Hormuz. Now, the numbers vary. So the normal peacetime flow, I gather, is about 20 million barrels a day. The reports in Axios, and I think the Wall Street Journal, may have said that it's up to about 10 million barrels a day recently, which I think seems rather high. The Financial Times story said about 4 to 6 million barrels a day, which would be between a fifth and something like a third of the normal flow. As is always the case, I'm the glass one third full, you're the glass two thirds empty guy. This doesn't solve the problem, but it does seem to me that coupled with other things that have happened, new sources of oil coming on the market, Venezuela, I think, is now pumping an additional million barrels a day. American production has gone up. There's production in other parts of the world. There is still there's a shortage of oil. Prices have gone up, not as much in the United States as in other countries, by the way, which is we sometimes forget. But I will say I've been somewhat surprised at the administration's ability to mitigate the absolute worst effects of this. So I don't know, what's your reaction to the news coming out of Iran?
Well, let me start with what you might call the tail effects of Operation Freedom, which the administration announced with great fanfare some months ago, which was to do what you're talking about, escort ships out of the strait to get the flow of oil going. So, yes, I mean, clearly some is, oil is getting out. Again, I think there's been a tendency for the administration to exaggerate, how much is getting out. It's very hard, as the Financial Times piece to which you referred points out, it's very hard to have much precision about this because many of the tankers that are coming out are doing it by turning their transponders off. So actually tracking exactly how much is coming out is not easy. I guess what I would say is yes. I mean, some of that has mitigated, as you say, some of the worst aspects of the shutdown of the strait that's resulted from the war. Again, as you point out, even in the best case, it's about a half of what was coming out before. But it also does not address a lot of the other economic knock-on effects of the closure. So it doesn't deal with ammonia, urea, sulfur, helium. There's stories this week about the material on which microcircuits are printed. Costs gone up 40-45%. And in large part, some of it's got to do with the mania for AI and all the pressure to have more chips, but a lot of it has to do with the fact that a Saudi plant that produces 70% of the stuff that goes into these things was knocked offline by the Iranians. So, yes, there's some mitigation here, but it's limited and it doesn't completely solve all the problems that have been created. On the question of that you raised at the outset of what I think would what in our academic hats we would describe as the potential for horizontal escalation of the conflict, spreading it out to other domains, not just the U.S. and Iran going at each other. I mean, the Iranians have also talked in the last week about possibly military activities reaching across Iraq into Kuwait and seizing parts of Kuwait. And for a while there, they were, when the U.S. was launching its retaliatory strikes for the Iranian strikes in the Gulf or in the Strait of Hormuz, the Iranians were going after Kuwait like nobody's business there for about 2 weeks. You know, this is actually a bit of a departure. I mean, the Iranians actually talking about not, I mean, obviously they, you know, took some Iraqi territory during the Iran-Iraq war, but the idea of going into Kuwait, this is a pretty big departure from, you know, what they've said before. So I agree with you. I think the potential for this conflict to spread is very, very high. The president, in his typical fashion, you know, announced yesterday kind of D-Day of economic warfare, you know, sanctions the like of which you've never seen. Secretary Bessent's been for a week promising he's going to announce big sanctions. Now it's put it off until Monday when he's going to make an announcement. I don't know exactly what is going to be in this sanctions package. It would seem that it's got to be secondary sanctions on countries doing business. The president seems to be advertising that in his Truth Social post by saying anybody does business with Iran, you're going to get hit with the sanctions hammer. I don't know, really. Is he going to be doing that to the Chinese when he's about to, you know, host Xi Jinping? Maybe. I don't know. But, you know, is it going to go the way of, you know, his threats of kinetic military activity, which is, you know, threaten and then pull back and say, is this being done to try and incentivize the Iranians to get more serious about negotiating? It's hard to know, but if you were sitting in Tehran, given the pattern you've seen, don't you think you would bet that this is just more bluster?
I'm not sure. I'm genuinely not sure. And this is a song I've sung here before. I think we tend to project on them. This is what I would think if I were an Iranian looking at this, but we're not Iranians looking at it. You know, we don't know how many times in the past they've assumed that he was going to do the taco maneuver. We don't know how much of a pinch they are feeling from various kinds of sanctions. You know, on the sanctions front, the UAE announced actually some fairly radical sanctions, which if they followed through, that would be a big deal because, you know, Dubai has really been kind of the Iranian windpipe to the rest of, particularly to the Western world. So I really don't know, but I guess what my going in thought is the world may look different to the Iranians than it does to us. I mean, their assessment of where they are. The one thing I would say, what we've clearly been doing is we've been sustaining some sort of blockade, and they haven't been able to export stuff. And I think, although they have incredible repressive powers, enabled increasingly, I think, by the Chinese, although that's been actually going on for some time. And if you look at the Iranian domestic security forces, they've been carrying Chinese kit for quite a while. But, you know, I'm sure they sense at some point they're not going to be able to do that forever. We don't know about the internal kind of machinations within the Iranian establishment. So I guess I'm just sort of uncertain about all of it. I mean, let me stipulate, we've mishandled this profoundly. That doesn't necessarily mean that the Iranians are in the cockbird seat, you know, where everything
looks. Catbird seat. Yeah.
Catbird seat. Yeah. Catbird seat. Sorry. And in fact, there's a part of me which wonders why are they making more and more outlandish threats? Like, you know, for example, taking part of Kuwait. I don't know how they would do that. I mean, unless they're talking about some of the smaller islands out there. But
yeah, I think the thought there is that this would be if Trump seizes Karg Island, they would then seize some territory back so that they don't – so that – I mean, I don't – look, who knows? I will stipulate that the Iranian economy is in terrible, terrible shape. And there have been Iranian economists, there have been some conferences of Iranian economists in Iran who've been telling the regime, we can't live with this much longer. And Iran International just had the other day some leaked tapes of conversations among besieged leaders where they're clearly, they know they're sitting on top of a volcano. So all of that, you know, is, you know, in play. So the president relying on sort of economic coercion right now is probably his least bad option. I certainly agree with that. And it might succeed. But on the other hand, you know, Iran has been the most economically sanctioned country in the world for two decades. You know, this is a little bit reminds me, and I think we may have said this before on the show, the Taliban always used to say, they have the watches, but we have the time. So let's see, you know, who can take the most pain. I'm not sure who wins that contest of ability to absorb pain.
Yeah. No argument there.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.
Just briefly on Ukraine, I don't know that there's a lot to talk about. I mean, just a more horrific, you know, bombardment of civilians in Kyiv by Russia, and a certain amount of bubbling kind of discontent in Ukraine. I mean, Fedorov, the former defense minister, made a speech saying, you know, contra to President Zelensky, actually, we really need to have elections in Ukraine. We can't use the war as an excuse indefinitely. Although public opinion on that score does appear to be at least sort of siding with Zelensky, but it's, but I think there is discontent about Zelensky in Ukraine as well. And then just finally, you know, this arrest of one of his top aides for corruption and the former ambassador to the United States. I mean, there's a lot of churn domestically in Ukraine, which in some ways is a good thing because it is indicative of a vibrant civil society and a functioning democracy, as opposed to Russia, where the chief economist at VEB gets fired because he has the temerity to, you know, say that Russia can't sustain what it's doing.
Yeah, Fedorov is a very popular figure. Dmytro Kuleba, the former foreign minister, also came out and said we should have elections. And I have to say I'm sympathetic to it. I used to not be as sympathetic, but increasingly I am for a couple of reasons. One, I don't think it's good to go forever without elections, as hard as it might be to do it. And you're right, it's a sign of a vibrant civil society. But I also, there's a part of me, you know, it seems to me that Zelensky fulfilled his historical mission, when he kept the country together during the invasion, when he very successfully wooed West European countries, and not just West European countries. You know, some dicey times with Trump, but even there, he seems to have kind of put things back on an even keel. But as you know, I'm absolutely convinced that you stay in power too long, you deteriorate in any of a number of ways. And it's, and the great thing about Ukraine is they have a number of very capable leaders who I think could do a perfectly good job of being president. And there are clearly things that need to be done. So I don't think that's so bad. Meanwhile, I mean, what's, you know, one of the things that's very interesting about Russia now is long gas lines, a lot of gas stations out of gas, these massive attacks on the Russian equivalent of Amazon. People are clearly feeling this.
Yeah.
People are clearly feeling the pressure of the Iranian, of the Ukrainian.
And Putin saying that the state will now intercede to rebuild the, you know, seven warehouses that the Ukrainians have destroyed.
And by the way, the Ukrainians, I think, have announced that they think within about 6 months they'll have ballistic missiles that can rain down on Moscow. You know, that'll be a different moment. We'll undoubtedly be talking more about that. I wanted to mention just one issue. The Wall Street Journal had a very good piece on this awful milestone that we passed, of the national debt being $40 trillion. So this is more than 100% of our GDP, which is that's a very bad moment. The best part of that piece, I thought, was they had a bunch of very interesting and informative graphics. Now, there was only one good piece of news in it, I thought, which is that actually the percentage of our debt, which is held by foreign entities as opposed to Americans of one kind or another, is gone down from about 50% down to, I think, about 30%. But in all other respects, this is terrible. And, you know, and if you look, you know, they also have some very powerful and disturbing graphics about American government spending. And you really see how squeezed the defense budget has been and necessarily will be. And some of this, unfortunately, is the fault of, you know, thee and me, my friend.
Multiple administrations through, yeah, right.
It's Medicare and Social Security. I mean, that, you know, the vast percentage of what we spend now is on individual entitlements to, among other things, to people like us, which is a big problem. But, you know, the other thing is interest on the national debt is now bigger than the defense budget. And I, you know, this is something that both parties have been profoundly culpable. I don't see either
totally party, irresponsible.
Totally irresponsible. I don't see either party addressing it. And what people, I think, don't fully realize is you don't have the same room that you did, say, during World War II to, you know, borrow an enormous amount of money and then, you know, pay for a war and eventually be able to pay it back. That's, we just don't have that kind of running room anymore, and it's a very disturbing and serious thing. And I sure as heck hope that we'll at some point get politicians who are willing to confront this one squarely. But I have my doubts.
I agree. I can't. There's nothing there that I can disagree with. I wanted to talk about one final item before we turn to a kind of retrospective of our 5 years here on the Bulwark. Which is Venezuela, which we spent some time on at the beginning of this year when Maduro was snatched by our special forces and brought and arraigned in the United States. I mean, interestingly, you know, sort of dropped out of the news, but just a couple of things that are striking. One is there's been a lot of contracts, in part as a knock-on effect of the war in Iran. There are a lot more companies that are willing to go into Venezuela and start pumping oil there, despite the very bad history that many of them have had with nationalization, et cetera. There have been a lot of contracts, and there's a lot of money. And where it has gone, it's not completely clear. which is a troubling phenomenon. But also, Delcia Rodriguez seems to have completely thrown, Maduro under the bus, which is only fair since he was originally a bus driver. Turnaround is fair play, I guess. But this is completely dropped out of the discussion that is going on between the Venezuelan opposition and the government, which is troubling in and of itself, because Maria Corina Machado, the leader of the opposition, has been excluded from those discussions. So I think in the watch this space category, I think we also need to kind of keep an eye on Venezuela because a lot going on there.
I agree with that. I'm not optimistic, but look, I do think this is the central foreign affairs problem that Marco Rubio is actually spending time on. I think he understands Iran he can't really affect. A lot of these other things he can't really affect. Venezuela he absolutely can affect, and I think he does. I mean, I think he's the guy who really plays the central role there. I wouldn't use the word sympathy, but I sort of understand the nature of the problem. I mean, here you have a profoundly corrupt dictatorship of a totalitarian kind in many ways. We decapitated it. We're trying to move it in a different direction. I am not sure that you – I keep on going back to the conversation we had with Stephen Kotkin. You know, when a regime like this gets decapitated, you still have hundreds of thousands of people who – or millions in some cases – who benefited from the regime, who, you know, the only thing they know how to do is to break kneecaps. And to some extent, if you can buy those people off, maybe not so bad. The same way when we knocked off Saddam Hussein, I think one of our mistakes was not figuring out, okay, how do you make this outcome okay at some level for the horrible, evil thugs that kept him in power? Because, you know, if you simply returned the liberal Democrat that we all like, how long does she last?
Right.
And no, I don't know.
So I take the point.
I mean, who knows? I'm keeping an open mind on this one. I know I would prefer she comes back, she becomes the new president, life is good. I just have this feeling that life doesn't work that way somehow.
Well, let's turn back the clock a bit. We started almost 5 years ago. And in some ways, the birth of this podcast came in the wake of an enormous failure, which was the collapse of the regime in Afghanistan and the totally shambolic U.S. Withdrawal. I had written about this in the Bulwark and elsewhere and done a long conversation in July with Bill Kristol where I was worried about, how this was going. And so we started, that was our kind of point of departure, was some of the mistakes that the Biden administration made. And then, of course, that was followed very, very quickly by, the buildup of Russian forces opposite Ukraine, and then ultimately the invasion of Ukraine, and then less than a year later the Hamas attack on Israel. So a lot of the first few years of the podcast were devoted to critiquing the Biden administration, despite the fact that both of us had endorsed Joe Biden and wanted him to defeat Donald Trump. I think we tend to lose sight of that in the fact that, the Trump era is measured in dog years, he's such an outsized personality. And as you and I were discussing the other day, this decade that since he walked down that staircase at Trump Tower, this is going to be, when historians write this, the era of Trump, whether we like it or not. Just curious about your reflections on, looking back. And then I'm going to talk about some things I got wrong.
Well, I have been thinking about it. I said, 5 incredibly eventful years. I would say I think we were right to be as critical as we were of the Biden administration, and indeed as we had been of the Obama administration before that, well, before the podcast. And what I find myself reflecting on is, in many ways, it's been a very bad time for American foreign policy and across a number of administrations, Republican and Democrat. And there's some matter for reflection there. As you know, all along, as central as Trump is, I think a lot of people have gone astray simply by saying, you know, it's all this, the fault of this monster. I think there have been other things that paved the way for him. There have been other things that have gone wrong, including in the administration that you and I served in, which have put us in what's actually now a very serious predicament. As I look back, I find myself more pessimistic than I was before, and which is in some ways comes naturally to me, although, you know, compared to you, I'm
little Mary Sunshine.
I'm little Mary Sunshine. So that's one thought. I know you don't fully agree with this, but I do feel Henry Kissinger was onto something when in this, I think it was a 2018 interview in the Financial Times with Ed Luce, he said he was asked about Trump, and he clearly didn't want to talk too much about Trump because I think Henry wanted to preserve access. But Henry was a very, very smart man. And he said, you know, Trump strikes me as one of these personalities who appears at the end of an era to expose its pretensions. And he said, and he probably isn't aware of that. It could all be a fluke, but that's sort of what I think it is. And I think there's some truth to that. And, you know, my view of Trump is complicated. I think he is both a very dangerous cause unto himself. He's to some extent a catalyst for other things that have been happening. And to some extent, he's simply a symptom of things. Last thing that I'll say, and maybe later on we can use this as a bridge to the next chapter in Shield of the Republic. I do hope that what we've been able to offer our listeners is some combination, which I think is unusual, of not only some detached reflection, some experience very considerable in your part, less so in mine, but still some of actual government service and, you know, what goes into the making of foreign policy and a long historical perspective. And I, you know, that'll, I think, be very, very important for us going forward, because I think we really need that. It's not just enough to have had experience, as important as that is. It's also important to be able to take a longer view. If we're into self-flagellation, I'll open the bidding.
You'll go first? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. And I'll say, I think I feel that I underestimated the resilience of the Russian military, the ability of Putin to keep a lid on that system. You know, I'm increasingly struck by the phenomenon of anchoring that Daniel Kahneman and other cognitive psychologists talk about, where, you know, there's an event that somehow seizes you and you sort of adjust everything off of that. So, you know, I think for me, it was the Russians lose 10,000 dead in Afghanistan. Gorbachev says, okay, we got to get out of here. And that's it. Well, you know, as we were talking last time, 500,000 dead. I think something somewhat similar with the Iranians, which is really quite, you know, that's something we have to take into account. Now, I think we also have to be careful not to overcorrect on that one, because, you know, even somebody looks, or a country that looks very resilient, can still at some point snap. But those are the ones that really, you know, have really struck me. I will say, I don't think, I feel quite confident that I was right in my critiques of Biden, of Obama, of Trump 1 and Trump 2. I don't feel that I in any way should be pulling back from any of that, just the reverse. So I'm, you know, I think on my basic judgments about where the United States is in the world and the decisions made by its leadership, I feel pretty good. So what about you? Let's hear your self-criticism session.
Yeah. So first, I share your self-criticism about the Russian military. I was, you know, much more bearish about their ability to survive everything that's gone on. And it's not just the initial failure to take Kyiv and the fact that their military was trapped and had to pull back and then lost a lot of territory in Kharkiv. You know, it's also the Prigozhin mutiny. And I did not think that the military could absorb these kinds of absolutely catastrophic World War II-like casualties in the modern era. I mean, it's one thing in the mid-20th century, but today to do this, I'm still to some degree astonished by it. I would say, too, and I don't want to attribute this to you. This is purely me. You know, this is sometimes you can sometimes know too much history, you know, and misread it. So if you know something about, you know, the history of the Eastern Front and Russian military during World War I, you know, the notion of a Russian army crumbling is not, you know, out of the realm of the possible. And given, you know, what we've seen, you know, I think I maybe relied a little bit too much on that. The other thing I think, you know, going back to the point that, you know, it was the failure in Afghanistan that got us started. And next week, while you're in Japan, I'll be talking to Paul Miller, who worked with us in the White House and Bush 43, and who has written a book called Choosing Defeat about the history of U.S. decision making in Afghanistan. I did fear that, you know, kind of long-range counterterrorism, what the Biden administration said it was going to do after the withdrawal, was a pipe dream, and that we would have more mass casualty attacks in Europe and the United States than we've had. And so in that sense, I think I, you know, underestimated maybe how much damage collectively we had done to al-Qaeda and the, you know, difficulties they would have reconstituting an ability to attack the United States. But like you, I don't, you know, I don't really feel that I need to, you know, pull back on too many of the judgments that I've had about either the Biden or the Trump foreign policies. I guess the one thing I would say that is an open question for me going forward as we go into this next phase of Shield of the Republic, well, we'll be independent, and I'll talk about that in a minute, is that I'm uncertain as to how much of the incalculable damage that has been done to the, you know, so-called liberal international order, but the global order as we've known it, both since the end of World War II and since the end of the Cold War, how much of that is irreversible, and how much, you know, can be bought back by different kind of leadership. And I'm not certain, I guess, what the capacity and the appetite of the American public is for what John Kennedy called paying any price, bearing any burden. Which was his inaugural call to Americans to continue the Cold War. You know, people forget that, you know, in December 1962, when he was interviewed by Bill Lawrence on ABC in the wake of the Cuban Missile Crisis, he said, "I know Americans are tired by 17 years of exertion in the Cold War," you know, and that was 64 years ago. So whether Americans are just tired of their exertion and unwilling, you know, to bear the burden of global leadership, to me is an open question. I think there's really a chance that we may be there. I mean, I think the other piece of it is that when Americans look at the disorder that results from us not playing that role, they don't like that either.
Right. I agree. I'm with you. I'm probably more pessimistic than I was on that score, in part also because I think that a lot of the kind of peripheral institutions that supported the kind of foreign policy that I think you and I both favor have weakened tremendously. And of course, the ones I know best are the universities, which have been, you know, are not what they were. We'll probably have some longer conversations. But, you know, even this latest scandal, which we're not going to get into it, Cambridge University, I think those people who are interested in it should read. There are a couple of articles, wonderful articles, really. I mean, courageous articles by Tyler Austin Harper in The Atlantic. Not just about the Jason Arday story, but some of the broader issues going on in academia. You know, the universities were a very important part of our ability to win the Cold War and to endure it. And there are other institutions of that kind, which I just don't think, you know, are there in the same way. I think about the labor unions. Think about the role that the labor unions played in the rise of solidarity in Poland. So
earlier in the Marshall Plan and defeating communists in Italy and France in the 40s.
You know, think of the really enlightened military leadership that you had for at least some parts of the Cold War. So I'm more concerned about these things. You know, I'm an American, so I never lose long-term hope. But I think one thing I will say I feel pretty confident in saying is I don't think this is going to be a quick snapback. I think it's not going to be the case that Trump is out of office in a couple of years and then you have a return to normalcy. That I find very hard to believe, but we'll see. And of course, Shield of the Republic will be along for the ride. So maybe you want to say a bit about what comes next.
Well, first, I think I would like to personally thank our colleagues at the Bulwark for giving us a home for the last 5 years. It's been great to go along for the ride of their phenomenal growth over the last couple of years, and very, very grateful for that. We're going to be doing a lot of new things, though. If you want to continue to listen to us and watch us, you can find us at shieldoftherepublic.com, which will take you to our Substack, where you will be able to access the podcast. If you like viewing the podcast on YouTube, you can find us at ShieldPod on YouTube, also on Instagram and on Twitter. We will be taking questions from our audience. So if you want to send us a question, you can send it to us at mailbag@shieldoftherepublic.com. We look forward to answering those questions. We'll be doing that probably a couple of times a month. But we're also going to be having other content that we're going to provide as well. I think some occasional short commentary by one or the other of us. I think we're going to be doing some book reviews together of books or groups of books. I think we're going to be doing some book reviews by each of us direct to camera. I'll be doing one, I think, next week. So lots of different things to look forward to as we begin a new adventure.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to. I want to throw one more bouquet. I, like you, very grateful to our colleagues at the Bulwark. I also want to throw a bouquet at our producer, Robert Edelman, who has navigated two not particularly technologically sophisticated older guys through the process of podcast and making us sound better than we really are. So thank you, Robert. But no, it's been a great ride for 5 years. And I have to say, I'm looking forward to the next five even more.